understand me now. If sometimes you see that I'm mad, don't you know no one alive can always be an angel?
This is Prison Pipeline on KBOO Portland. I'm Nicole Solomon Lindahl. Prison Pipeline presents a unique perspective of the criminal justice system, addressing the root causes of crime and broadening understanding of the institution of incarceration. In this episode, Ebony Howard, a certified recovery mentor and formerly incarcerated mother, and Jessica Katz, the director of the Family Preservation Project, describe a new project to honor and support women as they release from Coffee Creek Correctional Facility, Oregon's prison for women. Women releasing from Coffee Creek often do not have the help or support needed to get back on their feet, and many release with only one outfit provided by the Department of Corrections and nothing else. The goal of the Welcome Wagon Project is to provide additional outfits, hygiene supplies, and a warm welcome back into society. Ebony and Jessica will describe why the Welcome Wagon is needed, how the idea emerged, the current experience of women being released from prison, and the challenges faced by incarcerated mothers in reestablishing and maintaining connections with their children. Jessica, do you want to tell us a little bit about just like how this idea came to fruition and or just how it originated?
Sure. I think that the solutions to what's not working well in the system are enormous, and they're vast, and they're sort of hard to wrap your head around. And there was a group of women who started working with the YWCA, and they're all formerly incarcerated women, who created a program called Overcome. And they had a fairly vast network of both resources, human resources, and otherwise, and were working with us to meet women at the gate and bring them clothing and hygiene items and a ride to where they needed to go and sort of a warm handoff from somebody who had walked out the gates themselves. And that was incredible. And we were able on the inside to sit down and work with all the women and fill out referral forms about what they needed and their sizes. And women in prison wear men's clothing. So when we ask what size do you wear, they're like, first of all, I've been here for 5 years, so I have no idea. Second of all, I'm a 36, jeans, does that help? I'm like, not really. Bra sizes, underwear sizes, all of those things. And what's the style now? Like after 5 or 6 years, and people don't know. So it became clear that this was a bit more complicated than it appears on the face of it to get clothing and get somebody out the door. People are released very early in the morning. You don't always know when, what the time will be exactly, and people who are busy and juggling lives and kids and all of these things to be there was complicated. So women are also releasing to all 36 counties. Some people are leaving on a bus at 5 o'clock in the morning. No one was able to meet those people at the gate, so we were thinking about doing Amazon boxes, and all sorts of solutions bounced around. And then I thought, like, what if we just had a mobile, you know, reentry van that met people at the gate? So if they were going to Malheur County or wherever, they could also be greeted by somebody in a warm handoff. And because otherwise I couldn't wrap my head around how we could sustainably help women who are leasing to 36 counties with what they needed. And also, I think the value of having somebody meet you as you're walking out the doors who's done it themselves was immeasurable, because I can't even imagine like the fear and anticipation, anxiety and terror that might encompass.
So the idea behind the Welcome Wagon is that it's like a trailer, or it's morphed. It's kind of evolved over time, right?
Right. So the current vision is it's a mobile boutique. And I'll just say what the gold standard would look like, because I think it's fun to dream about it. It would have a hair chair so that somebody could be in the Welcome Wagon who could give a haircut. There would be a mobile, you know, boutique, so there would be clothing that's new in the sizes that people need, and shoes and hygiene items that are also culturally specific, because not everybody leaving prison has white girl hair, and I think that's important to get what you need. And there would be a network of people who have been served in some capacity through the Family Preservation Project or not, who could sign up to drive the van like 1 week a year as a way to remain connected to the program and to give back to other people, because I think that is a missing piece of what we need to be offering people, is a way to change the narrative and be in a role where you can actually be helping other people, and potentially with other volunteers, and they would meet people at the gate. There would be an area where you could try on clothes. Coffee, I'm told, was very important as we were building this idea. We have an advisory committee of formerly incarcerated women, and they were like, what about the coffee? I'm like, what do you mean? They were like, there's no coffee. That's what everybody wants, is some good coffee. And I was like, of course, good coffee. So coffee, a couch to hang out on, have a conversation with somebody who's been walking out the gates, maybe be able to get a haircut, some new clothing, and a meal, and then get on your way to where you're going. And it's not solving all of the problems in terms of what people need, and it's a big job, but I think it's a small solution to a big problem that could maybe make a difference.
So maybe we could talk a little bit about what the reentry process is like, what it's like without support, and what kinds of support would be helpful for people.
Okay. So my own personal experience, I was one of the few fortunate to have someone actually meet me at the gate. It was someone I actually met while I was in prison, and her mom and dad, and drove up from Roseburg to meet me. But for so many women, for the majority of the women there, they don't have any external support, any financial support, any emotional support or family that they can connect with. And when they release, they're releasing to an unknown with a laundry list of responsibilities. You have to check in with your PO, you have to be here, you have to be there. And, you know, like I was saying, it's similar to being dropped off in a foreign country that speaks the same language that you do, but you're carrying a backpack of deficits. You're a felon. You just got released. You don't know anyone. You don't have any income. You don't have any proper attire. You know, you have a flaming sign above your head that says foreigner, or, you know, something of that nature. And you're supposed to assimilate into society and community, and the community with what's expected to be not any issues. Your PO expects you to do it with flying colors. You might be involved with child welfare, and they expect you to do it with flying colors. You don't have any transportation. You're supposed to be at 3, 4, or 5 appointments during the day. You don't know where you're going, how to get there, and everyone expects you to make it. And it can be extremely overwhelming. It can be super stressful and defeating. And so many women find themselves unsuccessful with reentry because the cards are stacked against them, and without anyone to reach to or turn to that's been down that road or can support them in that journey, you know, they're going to revert back to what they know, and that's survival in whatever mode that may be.
Yeah.
So for there to be an opportunity to have a welcome wagon or some form of welcoming team there to meet you, you're provided with something to wear that, you know, that goes so far for especially a woman's self-confidence and self-image to come out, you know, glaring prison all over you. You're super self-conscious anyway. And it's like night and day. It would be night and day for someone who didn't have any support to walk out and see friendly, smiling faces and people that are encouraging and supporting and not demanding anything of them, but are there to assist them on their journey. So I did have this last sentence in Oregon. I had two previous sentences in Washington State in my 20s, and that everything has been drug involved. Yeah. All the crimes have been drug involved. So when I did get to Coffee Creek, I really took a hard look at myself and was just honest with myself, like, what's the bottom line here? Like, what's the serious issue? And I found that every one of my deviant behaviors and life choices all came behind relationships, and any drug addiction came behind a relationship. And so I was able to be honest enough with myself to identify codependency as my number one issue. And once I was able to address that, accept it and address it, and work mm-hmm. on my self-esteem and work on my own character defects and the things that took me out before, I've gone so far to the other side of the spectrum that I'm just, when I got out, I had 3 mentors. I had a prison fellowship mentor. I had a recovery mentor. I had this mentor. And I overdid because I didn't want it to not be enough. And I went and I got certification to be a certified recovery mentor. So I was able to help other women that were experiencing the same things. And to date, I've been a mentor for almost 2 years. I consider it an honor, a privilege, and a responsibility to reach back and to help the next person, you know, coming out of that gate, if possible, in any way that I can.
Yeah.
Because I know, even as capable as I felt I was, and I had someone meet me at the gate, she took me to my PO, they took me to get an outfit and everything, and they dropped me off in Portland. And yeah, that's the city I was from, but I literally walked around downtown dragging a suitcase for 4 hours because I didn't know what to do with myself. And I knew that I had to wait for my cousin to get home, and that was going to take a while. So I walked around in circles for 4 hours, just shell-shocked, because I needed to find a jacket. I didn't have a jacket when I released, and I knew there was a store over here that had, there was supposed to be a Ross. It wasn't there anymore, and I walked in circles for 4 hours looking for this store that was not there. And I, like I said, I consider myself a capable person. What about those who don't, who have all that, who are released into a town they don't know? And yeah, it's just, my experience wasn't all rosy, but I can't imagine, and I know how difficult it can be for someone who didn't even have that. So
yeah.
Is it okay if I have any question?
Of course.
Okay. So when I met you, it was in the capacity of fighting for your life for your
right.
youngest son. And I wonder how much your identity being rooted in being a mother mm-hmm. and having the hope of continuing to be a mother when you get out may have made a difference, and what might have happened if that weren't true, or what does happen to women that you knew at Coffee Creek who lost that hope completely.
That definitely did make a world of difference. And I get goosebumps on that, because not everybody or very few women have that opportunity. And without that opportunity, my life would be somewhere completely different right now. I know that for a fact. But I know that I couldn't just walk away from my children without being able to look them in the eye as adults and saying that I gave it my best effort. I did every single thing I could. And the fight for my younger son, the whole time, he went to foster care maybe 6 months before I went to prison. And for the duration of the 3 of the 4 years that I was there, there were 8 different times that they told me they were going to adopt my son out to this family or whatever family. And for whatever reason, it always fell through.
Wow.
And I didn't, without the intervention of the Family Preservation Project, I wouldn't have had contact with my attorney. I wouldn't have had contact with my DHS worker. I wouldn't have been able to see his kindergarten graduation on a video, you know, through. He had cochlear implant surgery, and I was able to get up-to-date information on his surgery day through this program. And this program is amazing, but without the avenue of communication, I would have lost that fight for my son. And if I had given up the fight for either one of my kids, my motivation for living differently would have been completely different. And for so many women, that's the last flickering candle in their idea that maybe life can be different, or maybe I can do better. And when that flame is snuffed out, so is their motivation and their desire for change. So to be able to allow a mother to have an opportunity to continue or to be a mother again in the future, it's there aren't words for that.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah.
If you just tuned in, you are listening to Prison Pipeline on KBOO 90.7 FM, Portland. I'm your host, Nicole Lindahl, with guests Ebony Howard and Jessica Katz, and we are discussing a new project they are launching to provide a warm welcome and support to women being released from Coffee Creek, Oregon's prison for women. We just heard from Ebony about her personal story of fighting for custody of her children, and we'll start the next segment by hearing from Jessica about the structural barriers that often prevent incarcerated parents from retaining their parental rights.
Jessica, maybe you can speak to some of the policy issues that don't take the human piece of this into consideration and kind of can have a really detrimental effect on families.
Sure. I mean, I think what we see all the time is where the child welfare system and the criminal justice system butt up against each other. So I think the average sentence for women in Oregon is 39 months. And there is a federal law called the Adoption and Safe Family Act, which dictates that if a child has been in foster care for 15 out of any 22-month period, that the state has an obligation to move towards a permanent plan for that child. And the sort of gold standard for permanency is adoption. And in order to complete an adoption, the biological parents' rights have to be terminated. So by the time you get to prison, you're looking at least 13 months, because that is a prison sentence as opposed to jail. You have been in county jail for a period of time, and if your case was open prior to that jail stay, you are fighting for your life by the time you even walk through the doors. And you don't have easy access to phones, to your caseworker, to attorneys. There are processes where you can, you know, connect with those people for sure. And the institution certainly does the best that they can. But for a system like the child welfare system that's already taxed, when you add a layer of that parent being incarcerated and not easy to reach, sometimes that communication is non-existent. And so your ability to advocate for yourself requires that you can use a phone. It requires that you have access to your attorney. It requires that you can write letters, take notes, file motions, appear at your court hearings, at your citizen review board hearings. All of these things are really difficult to do when you're incarcerated. And so to fight a termination, I think Ebony's better to speak to this than I am,
sure,
requires like every ounce of everything that you have. And when you're doing that, it's like from prison, you're pushing a boulder up a hill. And so one of the consequences, when we talk about collateral consequences of mass incarceration that we don't talk about enough, I don't think, is that one of the consequences could be that you, as a woman, irrevocably, or a man, lose the right to ever be a parent again. And so you lose all of these things in the fire on the way to prison and in prison. And a lot of those, I have seen women recover and get back, but I have not often seen women bounce back from having the right to ever be a mom again taken away from them.
And let me just clarify something. Like, it sounds like if you're not really first of all, if you're not informed about all of this, but secondly, if you're not fighting tooth and nail and hope, ideally having some outside support to do it, the path is to irrevocable termination.
Absolutely.
And that's simply based on the minimum sentence that you receive.
And fast-tracked at that. Yeah. And I have a perfect example. One of my GD students, while I was incarcerated, she had three children, and she was there, I want to say she had 2 years or less. It wasn't as long as my sentence. And I kept telling her about, you know, in the course of our tutoring sessions, we talked about our kids, and I was like, you know, I'm still doing this with my son, and still fighting for my son, and I kept encouraging her to go talk to FPP, because she's like, oh, I haven't heard anything, and mine are in foster care. And by the time she was willing to make a move and connect with them to make that phone call, she found out that her rights had been terminated without her knowledge, and her kids had been adopted 3 weeks earlier. She hasn't seen her kids since, and that's been like 6 years.
Wow.
And I think the other thing that happens, and maybe you can also speak to this better than I, is that as the agency is trying to achieve permanency, one of the things that they will often say to moms is that your best course of action is just to relinquish your rights. That's what's best for your child. And if you actually have your child's best interest at heart, you will just sign on this dotted line and give up the rights to be a parent. And if you do that, you will get to maintain some contact with them. But if you fight this in court, you'll lose everything.
Wow.
It happens. it happens way more often than people would realize. And not only the DHS department, the attorneys do it too, because that creates less work for them. We have an parent that's pretty much put on a shelf. They're incarcerated. They're a criminal. It's not going to get any better. We've seen the stats. So yeah, if you're willing, you know, just sign it right here and we'll make sure you have contact. But once a parent signs away their rights, there is no legal recourse open to them to enforce what they were told but wasn't ever put in writing. And so people sign away their rights under the impression that this is going to happen and it'll be fine and I can have contact and maybe we can do this, and none of it's factual. And one thing I tell any mother that is in that situation is don't sign anything without talking to someone first or reading through it. Don't just take their word for it. Make sure it's in black and white, but don't sign away your rights. Whatever you do, don't sign away your rights, because as long as that door is cracked, there's still a chance for it to open.
Can I just say one other thing about
please.
That? Okay. Because I think it sometimes can sound very sugar-coated and victim-y and all that stuff. So I think you would agree, I would agree, that there, in the course of your journey to prison, your kids have been harmed, right?
Kids have been harmed
by their moms on their path to prison, and they continue to be harmed. And so I don't want to, like, paint this picture that, you know, the moms are just purely victims in this and the kids have not endured any harm. I think we would all agree that they have, but what is presented is an opportunity to create a more coherent narrative for these kids about who their mom is and why she's there and what happened. And so when kids don't have that opportunity, they create their own story about what happened, and it's not generally pretty. So if their mom has an opportunity to get drug and alcohol treatment, to take parenting classes, to get an education, get job training skills, to work on themselves like Ebony took the leap of faith to do, then the outcomes are better. And the alternative to that is like putting an X through this person, and then the kids feel like they are also similarly cast off. You know, they don't have a strong sense of their own identity and self if their mom is considered to be, you know, bad.
And I'm not saying that every person, that this is the right decision for every woman. You know, for some women, parenting isn't the right choice, or they're not willing to live life differently, or they're not willing to accept accountability and responsibility for how the things ended up the way that they are. But for the ones that are willing to invest in that change, the battle is real, and it's fierce, but it's possible. And I know for my own case, I already had a bed in treatment. I had the highest paying position, which was $77 a month, by the way, that you can have in the women's penitentiary. And I had a trial day for parental termination, and they told me if I was not willing to be transported out, that I would lose my rights by default. So in order to be transported out, I'd be giving up my bed and treatment. I was giving up my work assignment. I was giving up all the things that it took me the 2 or 3 years I'd already been there to acquire. But I was willing to do that on that leap of faith, you know, that last chance hope. And I traveled from Wilsonville to Portland. It was a 16-hour trip, because I was in a holding tank that was just the worst thing ever in the Portland jail for 6 or 7 hours to be processed. Then I was transferred to Southeast Portland, 6 or 7 hours to be processed, and given bologna sandwiches all day. Not that I wasn't a criminal and didn't, you know, end up. But still, a 16-hour trip from Wilsonville to Portland
is normally a half-hour drive,
yeah,
right?
That's what it took me, a full day. And then the next day I go to court, and before we walk in the courtroom, the attorney comes to me and says that DHS is willing to drop the termination of parental rights petition if I agree to sign a paper saying that if I mess up any time in my 90-day transitional period post-release, that I would be automatically waiving my rights to my child. And if I was willing to sign that paper, then we could go. And I knew at that point that I was as committed to what I was doing as I could possibly be. And I was willing to sign that paper because this is saying you're not terminating my rights. And if it happens because I made another poor choice. And so I signed it and never looked back. And that was 3.5 years ago. So, wow. And I have both my kids and a puppy. So we did it right.
Wow. But I just, the amount of luck and perseverance.
Yeah, if at any point in that time I had said, you know, I'm not willing to give up my treatment bed, I'm not willing to give up my job, I'm not willing.
Well, and also if in that 90-day period, like, yeah, you had anything, talked about, if you had missed the bus, yes, and if shown I missed, up late.
Missed the like, bus, missed a visit, missed a UA, anything, and you're doing it all on public transportation.
Yeah, with that level of pressure behind it.
Knowing that you could lose your children because you miss a bus.
Yeah.
And because we've diverted so far from the welcome wagon,
I
was just going to try. That's okay. It's been a beautiful diversion, but just to, I think, tie it back together.
Sure, sure. Mm-hmm.
Knowing that all of these things are true, knowing that this is what women are up against and that they have ahead of them, and we don't have the capacity with the resources we have to change that. But I think what the welcome wagon hopes to do is to start that journey with maximum dignity and self-respect and an official way to say you've served your time, you know, you've met your obligation, and now we just want to welcome you back as a citizen, back in the community, as a resource, you know, to the community, and to provide that connectivity that you had mentioned. You have a network of strong-minded women who have had similar journeys, and I think that's pretty critical. Like you said, it's like being dropped in another country where people speak the same language, and to have the connection to other people who, you know, speak that slightly different language and totally understand your points of reference and maybe where your anxiety stems from is, and also a hope in creating this welcome wagon, that it is also creating community of folks who have walked the same path.
And another thing to consider about the welcome wagon is it's a visible, tangible representation of a support network for each person coming out. When they come out, they see that group of people that are there for them to support them and encourage them. And I know between the women that are involved even right now and not even knowing who may be involved in later, there's such a wealth of resources and knowledge and emotional experience and life experience that core group, seeing them in person and being there on the spot, on the scene, will be such a great jumping board, or, you know, diving board to move forward in life. And it's not like you just see them there at the gate and that's it. You have connections with those people as you're navigating your transition, and that would be an unbelievable opportunity.
This is Nicole Lindahl, and you have been listening to Prison Pipeline on KBOO 90.7 FM, Portland. We just heard from Ebony Howard and Jessica Katz about their new project to create a welcome wagon to welcome home women who are releasing from prison. If you're interested in supporting the welcome wagon, you can search for the campaign on the GoFundMe website under Coffee Creek Welcome Wagon, or get in touch with the Family Preservation Project, which is a project of the YWCA of Greater Portland. Links to these websites are on the webpage for this episode. Listen to this and previous Prison Pipeline programs at kboo.fm/prisonpipeline. Like Prison Pipeline on Facebook. Thank you to our engineer Michael Flactus, and have a good evening.
Baby, you understand me now. If sometimes you see that I'm mad, don't you know no one alive can always be an angel? When everything goes wrong, you see some bad. But I'm just a soul whose intentions are good. Oh Lord, please don't let me be misunderstood.
KBOO Community Radio is proud to co-sponsor Adroit Maneuvers, a new play.